Hello and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. I'm Jamie Guyon, host of the show, finally thawed out following an extremely cold trip to Helsinki last week. I'm joined this week, as ever, with Mike Wood. Mike, how are you doing?
Yes, very good, mate. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad at all. Like I said, just finally getting used to the temperature again. It was, without a shadow of a doubt, the coldest 3 days of my life. Thoroughly enjoyable trip as well, which we'll come to later in the show. But there's no other place to start after that fantastic late kickoff on the Sunday afternoon. It was Tottenham, Manchester City 3, Tottenham 3.
Johnson. Thackeray, they dared and they did.
Incredible late drama at the Etihad with that Kulusevski equaliser before the big referee and talking point of the match happened shortly after. Mike, let's just start sort of at the very top, the existential stuff. What did you make of it?
Good fun, really good fun. Apart from that, we lulled in the second half for about 20 minutes or so. I thought it was very interesting the fact that Ange made Pep blink first, moving back to the four at the back rather than pushing that defender into the midfield, such as Akanji was quite often doing. So it obviously spooked him slightly. I think it was interesting that Ange wasn't going to change his tune. We thought it would be could be a bit of a hiding and a sell, both in one sense it was in terms of the XG. It wasn't looking favourable towards Tottenham, but for whatever reason at this moment, and I think it's got something to do with John Stones being missing at present, that every time City get countered on, they seem to concede goals, and we know that because Ederson's not necessarily the best shot-stopping goalie. I think there's a lot to count in this game, and I thought just what Andrew's doing is so positive. It's such in the right method that Spurs wanted for the last few years now in terms of what the manager can bring in terms of a culture and a playing style. That it was an excellent game of football, probably one of the best of the season.
Yeah, it was a ding-dong battle and it was thoroughly interesting for a number of reasons. It was clear fairly early on and it obviously led to the first goal that Spurs, there's been a few comments suggesting, you know, oh, Ange said he would stick to his principles and he didn't. He did things differently. I don't think that's quite accurate. I think he absolutely did stick to his principles, but, you know, you're going to adapt them slightly depending on your opponents. And I think what you've seen in this game was that they were still playing out from the back, but they were sort of starting from a much deeper position generally and then keeping the front three sort of on the halfway line at all times, ready to pounce. And, as you said there, Mike, that Pep had to blink. And I think that was because, you know, he had in the first half, it was Hill, Kulusevski and Son just on the halfway line the whole time. And he doesn't have the quickest back four. And like I say, you've seen that with the first goal. It Spurs win the ball back and counter so quickly. It must be like one of the longest assists from Kulusevski, from where he plays that ball to where it ends up in the back of the net, and slightly questionable goalkeeping from Ederson. I think that was poor letting it through him like that. But Son is an efficient finisher, as we've seen. But I suppose that was the good of Spurs in the early stages, and then the bad of Spurs with the equaliser coming fairly shortly thereafter, and then giving up chances to Haaland missing and absolute sitter at the back post before Foden then puts them 2-1 up. And that Foden goal was so peculiar because he scores from like 6.5-7 yards out. It looks like a tap-in, but you know, they've kind of played themselves into that position, born out of Spurs trying to play out from the back and then being caught so deep. So I think that, like, in the first half you've seen, Mike, that Spurs were very much sticking to their principles, but he makes that change at half time and brings on Højbjerg for Brian Hill, who is Brian Hill's a weird player, isn't he? I don't think he's particularly good, but he sort of like seems to do everything at a million miles an hour. Like he's a little whippet. But there was positives because Brennan Johnson was playing well, and Son had been playing well, and it allowed Kulusevski to sort of move into that three and put Højbjerg into the midfield. And it was a slightly more defensive look about the side, Mike, which maybe led to that kind of 20 minute lull you referred to. But in that 20 minutes, it seemed that Spurs maybe got more control of the game than they had had in the opening period.
Yeah, I still think that's something that Ange strives for in his teams, as much as they try to get back to front as fast as possible. But as they progress and as they evolve as a team, they do want to gain more control. And Højbjerg's, while he's been marginalised since his arrival, I do think he's going to be kind of pivotal in the season going forward, especially now Ange's had to really use his whole squad because of the glut of injuries that they've had throughout their lineup. But I just think that the way that they are going about things makes it very interesting. And I think that really the rivalry, I suppose, between the coaches stems back to a friendly back in Yokohama 4 years ago, where Pep kind of got cottoned onto this kind of inverting the fullbacks, which Ange was doing in Japan at the time. Because they're both City Group as well, there's some shared learning there. I think he was very impressed by the fact that I think it's only one or a few games where a Pep team has had less possession. And remember, this is, like Man City going up against a Japanese outfit, not necessarily one of the best teams in the world. And while it was a friendly, it was a strong lineup just before the Community Shield at that point as well. So I do think, like, while we talk up Pep, like saying like he likes managers that play a certain way, but he absolutely thrashes them, I think he does genuinely have a lot of respect for Ange and what he does, what he's capable as a coach. And I think it kind of showed by the fact that, yes, they created chances. Yes, he wasn't going to criticise the ref for the draw, but I think he respected like how much that Tottenham put into the game, that they did get something out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ange said before the game that this was less about the result, less about the performance specifically, and more about mentality. He wanted to see that against the toughest opponents in Europe, that his players were willing to do as they were told. And, you know, the chap I watched this game with, you know, kept having an aneurysm every time Spurs were trying to play out from the back. And he was like, you know, sometimes the players have just got to take onus on themselves and start hoofing it up the pitch. And he referred to a Celtic game in a Champions League qualifier under Ange, where sort of 15 minutes to go, Joe Hart just started lumping it up the pitch and stopped kind of playing out from the back. And I, you know, rebutted that by saying, well, actually, if anything, Ange is probably delighted about that, because it means that the players are sort of two-footed into what they're being told by Ange, that this is how you've got to play no matter what is going on. And it's a risk versus reward, isn't it, Mike? Because it definitely leads to the Foden goal, for example, but the way that they are able to play it and pick their passes is what leads to their own first goal. And then Ben Davis sort of stepping out from the back and winning that incredible header is what leads to the late equaliser as well. So if you're a Spurs fan, you've had years of Conte and Mourinho, but you must be not only heartened by the performances, but heartened by the mentality of the squad and their sort of sheer determination to do exactly what they're being told by Ange.
Yeah, and I think it comes to Kulusevski as well. He says he loves that. He loves the kind of game plan, and I suppose you would, when it's attacking and suited towards you rather than being a defensive kind of wing-back under a Conte system, for example. But like you said, it gets everybody to buy into it, and that can only be a positive thing for building the culture of a club and a style of the club. Now, there's no necessarily right way to win. There's obviously more entertaining ways to win a game of football. The Spurs have shown it in the main. And like I said, if they lost this game, especially after going 1-0 up, it would have been the fourth game in the trot that they would have lost after being in lead. And while they've thrown away, in inverted commas, a lot of points this season, the vibes around them are still good. And it's not a vibes in a kind of sarcastic way. The mindset of Spurs have changed, and it's changed in the main across like the rest of the league as well. They don't see them as a soft touch anymore. Now they see them as a team that are going to go toe-to-toe, face-to-face with you and really put it up to the biggest teams possible. And while like you could say, oh, it's potentially silly against Chelsea, like everything's situational. This wasn't a game designed where Spurs were going to win the game. It would be really nice if they won the game. But in terms of how premature Ange is in his kind of reign, he needs the players to buy in just to find out which ones are here to kind of ready and go for the fight and he can rely on, and which ones get jettisoned to the side. And I think because of, as we just talked about there, like the squad injuries as well, Lo Celso's coming in and he's chipping in with the odd goal now. And Kulusevski's not in his best run of form, but I think he scored 3 successive times against the champions now, which the last person to do that was Danny Murphy, of all people. So it shows you that he's got a kind of temperament about him, especially in the big games, to perform. And like I said, this is all without Kane, of course, as well, who's going over to Bayern Munich and hit the ground running there to show you what a lethal important finisher is. And it's not been all roses, like the red cards, the kind of silly challenges, Richarlison not really coming to the fore either. There is kind of question marks about the whole thing. But considering where Ange was picking up Tottenham from, I think where he's gone so far, you can give him nothing but praise.
Yeah, the word vindication has been used a lot around the media after the result, in that it was 3 successive defeats, and even if it was against Man City, had it become 4, there does become a few question marks about the style, and some of your sort of classic football men were starting to ask those tedious questions. So there is a degree of vindication. And Kulusevski also became the first player to score against Man City in stoppage time twice as well, with a 90th minute equaliser and previously a 95th minute winner. Son was playing out of his skin as well. You know, he's obviously unfortunate for the own goal for the City equaliser, but other than that, was playing out of his skin and had an absolute blinder. From City's perspective, Mike, they've now drawn 3 consecutive Premier League games, granted against traditional Big Six teams. They've also conceded 10 goals in their last 4, if you include the 3-2 game against Leipzig in the Champions League. So they're shipping goals. They've dropped points in 5 Premier League games altogether. And I know we always say that, you know, City start bad or start poor and then they kick on, but they generally don't start this poorly. And it's the lack of control in these big games where they keep conceding several goals that's going to be the most concerning thing for Pep and City fans, isn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose control being the key word there. Like, the draws that they've had are not necessarily poor draws in the sense of the opposition that they're coming up against, but yeah, it's the fact that every time the ball comes into their half and they've got defenders turning back towards their own goal, they look like they're going to concede, which is very kind of un-Pep-like, and it's uncontrolled and it's unstructured and it causes chaos. And if there's one thing a Pep team can't deal with, it's chaos. I think he said in the Chelsea game, he referred to Diaz like it's like the anxious one in terms of giving away the penalty, just because everything around it just came so distorted and disorientated. That yeah, it's a worry in the broader sense, but I do think it can be remedied if when De Bruyne comes back and Stone steps back into the midfield and doing the Kanji role better than. I suppose there's only a few players that can do that in the world, and I think they all play for Man City. It's like Stones and Rico Lewis are the only two players that can really do that proper, just step into the midfield and look like
as a centre back.
Absolutely. And just like it's those small things. They've not been able to replace Gundogan, who's gone to Barcelona. Grealish has gone off the boil. I seen somewhere like he's every game he started this season, which is only 3 in the league. He's not been booked, but he's been booked in every one of his sub-appearances, and then he misses the Aston Villa game. So it shows you his temperament seems to be a bit off, maybe too eager to please or too annoyed at not starting, because he's seen Duke come in and kind of be the Jack Grealish of old, and he's maybe kind of resentful about the fact that he's now getting on and he's getting older, and Pep didn't really want that when he first came in, and now he's letting this young lad do all the stuff that I used to do. As well, so there is that kind of case to it as well. But Alvarez in the midfield, I think it's all right in the games where you're dominating and you can control it, but against like teams who are closer to your equals, I think you see him exposed slightly as well. So I do think Pep, much like when he did put Stones into the midfield, he's got to figure out or think about something to get wrestle control back, I suppose, from his opposition at the moment, because it's just a certain. It's in too much into chaos, which suits teams like Tottenham, but definitely not Man City.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just having a look there while you were speaking, Mike, about sort of where Man City were at this stage last season. And yeah, bizarrely, they're actually only 2 points worse off than they were at this stage last season. So after 14, they'd drawn 2 and lost 2. And this season, they've obviously drawn 3 and lost to. So, and conversely, Arsenal are 4 points worse off. So it's really strange how it does genuinely feel like City aren't as strong as they have been in previous years. But we all keep saying, you know, they always kick on. But actually, they're really there or thereabouts from where they were exactly at this stage last season. And slightly more peculiarly is that Tottenham are only 1 point better off than they were at this stage last season under Conte, which is, again, just goes to show, we've spoken at length about the vibes and the culture and the feeling around Spurs, but if you think about where we were standing with Conte Spurs 14 games in last season, you know, it was doom and gloom and misery, and could they get into the top four? And after the same amount of games this season with, you know, one more point, it's, are they title challengers? They're brilliant, they're great, it's all going in the right direction. It is quite fascinating. You know, Chelsea 2 points worse off than they were as well, with a sort of similar change of mentality. So it is interesting, and City probably then won't be as concerned as perhaps some of the football writers are suggesting they need to be. But the continuation of chaos is probably going to be the thing that they need to try and nip in the bud. I'm just trying to have a look at their goal scoring record last season. So they had scored 40, conceded 14 this year, scored 36, conceded 16. So, you know, ever so slightly poorer defensively, ever so slightly poorer going forward. Another question I have, Mike, was just, you're referring to Doku there in a comparison to Grealish and how, you know, Doku's been allowed to kind of crack on and do his thing. But how much do you think that's impacting both the control and the causing the chaos, and then also the fluidity of Man City's attack? Because he's an incredibly individual player. He's extremely different to anything, not only anything City have, but probably anything really in the league in terms of maybe except Wilf Zaha, you know, last season, in terms of like a old-fashioned, he could play as a winger in a 4-4-2, kind of like chalk on the boots kind of guy. Gets the ball, runs at people. And something I observed, particularly in the first half, was that his desire to beat a man and make a run was making it really difficult for Haaland to make the right runs. There was several times where Haaland was sort of like dipping off the shoulder of the last defender, but then Doku started running, and so Haaland had to readjust his positioning because the ball didn't come in. Or he would make a dart to the front post or something, but Doku was standing his man up and trying to take him on. And it seems that the connectivity and fluidity between them, despite all the excitement around Doku, isn't there either, perhaps fits in there somewhere.
there probably is something to that. Just because the way Haaland likes to operate, obviously, he likes that kind of ball into the heart of the half space that De Bruyne is playing, or he likes a run off the back post where he can flick on a header. And you're right, it's all about the timing of the run. And I suppose that's kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two through hours and hours of training, and just understanding that great players kind of have and forge through playing with one another in game situations. And I suppose the Doku situation is that he's not necessarily a great creator, he's a great dribbler. And he has got a flourish of assists already so far this season. But you would not necessarily say he's got like the playmaking ability that some of the best players have, but just like some of the other players in this league have. And it's just something that he'll have to iron out in his game from where he's come from. But like, he's got an exceptional talent. He obviously drags defences apart with his dribbling and his skill. And it's just something, I guess, it's just another kind of, I don't think he's maybe necessarily meant, nobody ever thought he was going to make this impact as quickly as he has and push Grealish at the team. So I don't know if there's a bit of that where Pep's trying to coach him into his way of thinking and his way of to do things and what he needs from him. But because he's been that good and Grealish has kind of fell out of favour, he's had to rely on him so heavily within the season. And I suppose when I've said like they're missing key players, like you forget about some of the other players that they've also moved on or sold, like Mahrez as well. Like Mahrez, as much as he was like kind of a peripheral figure at points this season, throughout his tenure at Man City, he'd always pop up like important goals or chipping at the right time in the right moment. And I don't think he was unheralded by any means, but I think his importance to this kind of squad depth as well is something that's also been missed. And it's just, I think they've got, so far into all the competitions last season, obviously winning a good majority of them as well. It's a bit like the kind of Liverpool fatigue factor from last season and the season before that. Like that, these guys are not necessarily running on fumes, but it's like how far can you push them this early on in the season as well? You still need to manage, and this is without the hectic Christmas schedule that have coming up later in the month as well.
Yeah, and it's a motivation factor as well, isn't it? We spoke about the fatigue with Liverpool, and there was a degree of like motivational fatigue in that they had come so close again. And was that the season they were in the Champions League final as well, and they lost that to Madrid, and they won the two cups against Chelsea. So it was a bit like, you know, a couple of trophies to show for it, but nothing brilliant. Whereas, yeah, and with City last season, they obviously won the treble. So there's got to be an element of motivation there as well. And then you look at the subs that that City had available to them in this game as well. And it's not like, you say, being able to bring on somebody like Mahrez with 20 minutes to go, who's going to cause a knackered fullback all sorts of problems, not necessarily through blinding pace, but more generally through his ability on the ball and his ability to pull people in different directions. You know, instead, they brought Ake on for Vardiol, which is, you know, pretty much like for like. They brought Kovacic on for Alvarez to give them a bit more control. It's arguably a negative change. Likewise, Rico Lewis for Foden's pretty negative. The only one that's kind of like an attacking player that causes the team a different question or has fresh legs in an attacking sense is Grealish coming on for Doku, and he obviously gets a goal. But there are other options, you know, Calvin Phillips.
The great
Sunderland goal scorer. Gomez, Oscar Bob, and John Stones, who keeps appearing on the bench but doesn't actually seem to be anywhere closer to making it onto the pitch. So, and they did sign Matias Nunes in the summer to sort of try and strengthen that midfield before he got injured. But they've only actually got Nunes and De Bruyne in terms of the first team squad injured. It's not like Man City are really missing anyone. Rodri suspended for this coming game against Villa, which is going to have a huge impact on them. You would have thought Kovacic will probably play instead. And I tell you what, if Man City had Newcastle or Man United or even Chelsea's injury lists, then they could be finding themselves in quite a bit of bother, because Newcastle had 11 first team players out, United sort of 9 or 10, Chelsea there or thereabouts as well. City don't really have the squad depth for that. You know, they would have ended up bringing in Oscar Bob would be starting, Phillips would be starting. So it's quite fascinating sort of where they've, for a team that were sort of built in Sir Alex Ferguson's Sir Alex Ferguson's ideology of always moving, always improving. If you don't improve, you're standing still. They seem to have got themselves in a bit of a rut this year. But I guess more broadly speaking, Mike, it's fantastic news for the potential title race with Liverpool and Arsenal now above Man City, rather than sort of last year. It was really just Arsenal that were challenging them, and potentially Newcastle and Villa aren't a million miles away either, and Spurs themselves. So from that perspective, I guess as neutrals, we're all pretty content with it.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's been a while since we had a proper three-horse race for the title. Mm. I'd imagine, even extending into this kind of young period of the season, only 14 games in. So I do think Man City are probably still the best team in the league. I don't think there's much argument in that case, but I do think there is obviously they've got the weaknesses, as we just touched upon there. And Arsenal especially defensively, they look especially strong. They don't seem to. Man City actually remind me of Arsenal last season in defence. Like they've got their lapses in them. You can see the kind of frailties and the deficiencies there. Whereas Liverpool, they're not quite as strong defensively as we've seen in the film game, of course, but just going forward, they probably look like the most cohesive unit of the three. So I think they've all got their kind of strengths and weaknesses, and I think that's why in one-off games they could definitely beat each other, but it's also why they could push each other perhaps deep into the season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Liverpool are maybe a team that are a season further down in the making in terms of this adaptation than perhaps Man City are. And Arsenal obviously are now sort of 3-4 years into their development, and if they can keep more players fit or would hope to push that further, because they're not sort of swashbuckling and pushing teams aside like they did, but they're winning tough games and they're winning games in a slightly different style, which you're going to need. And Villa are only a point behind Man City, which is going to make for a fascinating game in the midweek. Let's come on to that then and look ahead to, I think it's Wednesday's tie, City against Villa. And you were just talking about City's defensive frailties there, Mike. The only team that have scored more home goals than Aston Villa this season is? In Europe. The only team that scored more home goals than Villa.
I'll go PSG.
Close. Bayern Munich. Sense it was one of them rather than geographically. But yeah, Bayern Munich. And without Rodri, with that control in the middle, and generally City's lack of control, I think this strikes me, a Villa, that if there's ever a good time to play City and there's ever a bad time to play Villa, this is exactly it, because we've described Villa as a powerful team several times so far this season, and with City being ever so slightly weaker in strength-wise without Rodri, definitely without Grealish, who's suspended, potentially without Doku as well, and then the power of, you know, Watkins, Bailey, and Diaby on the counter attack against, you know, Vardy, Ake, Rodri. It could be a really, really exciting game, this, couldn't it?
No, absolutely. I'm pretty sure there was no Kovacic that said his hardest opponent in the Premier League was John McGinn as well.
So yeah, it was. If he gets
drafted in, yeah, John McGinn running over the top of you, that'll not make for an easy night, especially at Villa Park. Like I said, I didn't know that about the goals scored, but it's 14 wins out of 14 at home under Emery as well. So I know while their away record is patchy in parts, just like the 2-2 we got against Bournemouth, but at home they seem to be a different animal. And while they're not the complete package yet, like they're going great guns, especially in Europe and especially in the league at this moment in time, like as we've seen, like maybe a Brighton not kind of keep up with the pace, they'll have definitely kind of kicked on into the next kind of year and managed to deal with the Thursday night football as well on top of that. So I do think, I don't think I'd be surprised if Villa win this game. And then if Villa do win this game, then City are going to have kind of real questions of, like, how do we reassess this and move forward? Because, like I said, it's a busy schedule. You're trying to get players back, but you're just trying to get players off the treatment table to try and get them back into the squad at this point in time now to get them ticking over the Christmas period. And that goes for all teams as well. It's not a time to be out on the training ground because the game's coming out quick and fast. So I do think there's a lot of kind of aspects going to this game that could really put a spanner in for the works, especially when, like, an Arsenal's got a Luton Town, which you definitely perceive to be maybe the easiest or the second easiest game. And if that's not the easiest game, then Liverpool will go to Sheffield United, which is definitely the easiest game at this moment in time as well. So I do think it's a bad midweek for Man City, fixture-wise, considering what your opponents are up against.
Yeah, absolutely. And even Spurs against West Ham, it's a bit of a derby, but Spurs at home will fancy themselves there. And suddenly the league table could look very different. And for City as well, they not only do they not have the break that they had last year with the World Cup, which Haaland obviously stayed at home for, which made a difference, you would have thought, to his understanding of what was being asked of him. They also have to go to the Club World Cup, which comes in the few days before Christmas. So, you know, they could find themselves on the same points as Tottenham in joint fourth. And, you know, with a trip, where is the Club World Cup this year? It'll be somewhere.
Saudi. It's always kind of Saudi Arabia. I'll double check that for you, but I'm pretty sure it's Saudi. Is the next year it goes to like 48 teams?
It's in Saudi. It's in Saudi. Oh, funny that you say that like slightly facetiously and then it transpires to be entirely true. That runs from the 12th to the 22nd of December, but City will miss the first round, go straight into the semis, so miss the first couple of days. But yeah, like, that's not an ideal bit of travel, because they don't get a break until sort of the first weekend in January, and then they're into FA Cup you know, third round fixtures before a week off. So
That's Oscar Bob time. That's Oscar Bob time.
Give him his run out. Who did Man City get in the third round of the cup? That was just this week, wasn't it? This weekend. Because you've got a Tyne Wear derby. First Tyne Wear derby since 2016. We are going to talk about Newcastle, so we can...
Huddersfield, that's who they got. So not too bad.
Who famously beat them in their first season in the Premier League. So,
Right enough. I suppose we should touch on the FA Cup ever so slightly. Like Arsenal getting Liverpool, 4-0 Prem ties, like you said, the Tyne Wear derby. Suppose the potential for the biggest giant killing would be Gillingham going hosting Sheffield United. I think that's always the one disappointment in like the FA Cup is, especially if you're like two leagues below another team, that you don't automatically get the hosting kind of rights because like if you flip on its head, Sheffield United going to Sheffield United hosting Gillingham, even you think if Paul Heckenbotham is still in charge, which I suppose we should touch upon as well. But
We'll come to that next.
You think maybe Gillingham wouldn't have enough, but now you flipped on its head, Gillingham's got the cold showers, the big terrace, and all these things that every shitty wee team apparently in the country has outside the Premier League and the Championship has. That's got potential for an upset, but when it's the big team hosting, you think maybe that chance is gone.
Yeah, the big one from the draw is as you say, it's a Tyne Wear derby, isn't it? It's the first one since 2016, sort of been sort of coming on 8 years by the time you get round to it, which is pretty remarkable, actually. And the way Newcastle are playing at the moment, I'm sure they'll be excited for it. But Sunderland are no mugs and did well in the Championship last season and doing well in the Championship again this season. But we will move on. Mike's ruined the big old exciting news that we've been brewing on the pod for some time, and that relates to Burnley 5, Sheffield United 0.
Here's an opportunity for Obafemi to try and backheel it, and then the shot's driven in. It is 5, and it's the captain Brownhill from the edge of the box. They were queuing up. You have a go. I'll have a go. It's giving it to Mac.
No prizes for guessing which club commentary that was.
Is that club commentary or was that local radio?
No, it was Sheffield United TV.
Right, because I was going to say, either or, local radios sometimes have the best clips of like their own team, whether they're struggling or they're going well. I remember one, it was like Newcastle, I think it was like in the Championship season where they're really struggling and the boys bearing down and goal. And he just goes, just put it in the net. It's just like, you don't get that like on Sky Sports. As much as Martin Tyler is allegedly plays in Liverpool goals and hams up the Man United goals, it's nothing to those extremes. And I'm all for that kind of, I was going to say shit-outs, and that's not the correct phrase. Just good times.
Playing to your audience, not being outrageously biased, but you know that folk are listening to you because they're probably supporting Newcastle. Yeah, the co-commentator there, in the background, is exactly what you want to hear. It was Burnley 5, Sheffield United 0. Paul Heckenbottom has finally got his jotters and finds himself the first manager sacked 14 games into the season. Remarkable that we've got this far, to be fair, without a sacking. And as is often the way with these things, it might be the start of a few more to come. On the game, first of all, let's start, Mike, with Burnley, because we will be able to talk, obviously, at length about Sheffield United shortly thereafter. Good win for Burnley, obviously, 5-0. Get it started quickly. Fantastic start on match of the day. I'm not sure if you heard, J. Rodriguez becomes the first player in Premier League history to score 2 goals, which were timed within the first 15 seconds of the game. And he brilliantly replied, 2. Not to be reminded of the other one, which was a Southampton game, which is quite funny. But, Alan Shearer went to town on sort of how disgraceful Sheffield United were right from the start, losing out on 3 tackles and then letting Jay Rodriguez get in for the goal. And you kind of knew the floodgates were going to open from that point onwards. And they duly did. Burnley playing more of the football they played last season. Match of the day highlighted them going a bit more direct at times. But for me, Mike, I thought I thought the panel of Match of the Day and a couple of the other writers and the radio and podcasts I've listened to today have got a little bit carried away on this in terms of their praise for Burnley. You know, their only two wins this season now have come against Luton and Sheffield United. And, you know, what does that tell us? It tells us they might finish third bottom instead of bottom. Sheffield United are the worst team in the league by a country mile. And yeah, Burnley beat them. Yeah, they beat them 5-0. But actually, there was nothing in their style of play or in any of the goals, in fact, either, that made me think, yeah, this is a team that are really starting to get onto something, that are going to cause trouble to guys higher up the league. For me, this was more of a sign, as we'll come to, of how bad Sheffield United were than how good Burnley were. Don't know, but perhaps being a bit harsh.
No, I can't add anything in honest. When a team or an opposition is so poor, and so poor as Sheffield United were, in terms of just giving up from like the first whistle, then you can't really leap praise on the victors. And it's just the case that, like I said, what do we know about Burnley? They won the championship ahead of the two teams that they beat so far this season, and they've probably proven over the early stages of the campaign, while Luton maybe have a few more points, Burnley in the long run will probably finish, like you said, third bottom, and the way things are going. So it's like you can't really analyse these games in any great detail, because it's just a case of, like Alan Shearer quite succinctly put, like just in terms of effort and endeavour and trying your hardest. And I know it's very dull and cliched, and it's not very kind of progressive necessarily thinking, but it's just a case like this is a squad of players that have down tools, down on confidence, and just don't have the ability to hang at this level, even against the likes of Burnley, who are poor within themselves.
Yeah, I think you've put it fairly well there, and I actually think there was maybe an element of Match of the Day feeling almost obliged to be complimentary to Burnley in the circumstances, given that Alan Shearer was like, yeah, Burnley were great. They played great football. They were great. And then they're like, what about Sheffield United? It's like, they were a disgrace. They were an absolute disgrace. Look how bad they were. They didn't defend this right. They didn't defend that right. They didn't win any tackles. And you think, not sure both those things can actually be true. I don't think one team can be that good and one team can be that bad. Usually it's like a pendulum. It has to sort of swing proportionately, I would say. So I think we'll hold off on any sort of overly excited praise. But it was nice to see Vincent Kompany happy on Match of the Day, having a wee chat with Gary Lineker about a win for a change. And I did enjoy his frighteningly optimistic response to the question, you're used to being at the top of the league, how do you find the mentality shift at being at the bottom? He says, oh, it's exactly the same. You just take it, you still just take it one game at a time. You shut out the noise, you focus on yourself, and you try and win. And you're like, yeah, but the difference being is that every Monday you come back in the dressing room having not won. I think that's the question, Vincent. But he did a good politician's answer, did well to sort of bat that one back at Gary Lineker. On the other side, Sheffield United. Mike, the worst team for me that I can remember in the Premier League ever. And I'll caveat that with a degree of honesty in that I couldn't tell you if Derby in 2007-08 were actually bad, because I can't really remember. You know, it was 16 years ago and I was sort of 15, 16. So no, I don't recall if they were specifically awful week in, week out. But I've probably got a solid decade to 12 years of being able to specifically remember the bad teams that we've had in the league. And this is genuinely the worst. They are absolutely dreadful in every single area of the park. Wes Frothingham is not a Premier League caliber goalkeeper. I think sort of two or three of the goals go through him, the first one and certainly the last one. And then you could probably do that all over the park. And Paul Heckenbottom said after the game, you know, some players have played themselves out of this team. Ironically, he'd just managed himself out of the club at the same time. And there is an element of, the players aren't there. No, there's not an element. It's largely because the players aren't good enough. But then as well, Mike, I'm sort of asking you two questions in one here. As well, Heckenbottom also did absolutely nothing to try and galvanise that squad or create any kind of harmony or buy into the cause.
No, and when Ollie McBurney's already got one red card this season, throwing him into a potential must-win game and getting another red card wasn't kind of the
pathetic as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a disgrace, and it shows you kind of person and the kind of player that he is, and that's why he's getting nowhere near Scotland squads these days, and probably played one of his, maybe his last game, he won't play his last game, he'll play under Wilder, of course, but he's played his probably his last season at the top flight with that as well, but it's fine, we'll go to Rangers or something, have a whale of a time.
I will.
But, I think Heckenbotham, he was on hiding to nothing in the sense that the club shook it. This was a club, if it didn't go up last season, it would have been in administration. They were struggling to keep the lights on. They had to cut corners. They were like weren't topping up like the understudy heating or turning it on. So like this is a club where the guys try to sell up as well. There's not been any takers so far. So he was hampered by a lot of like off field issues that pertain to stuff like couldn't he spend much of his budget. So he had to stick with what he's got. So there is that factor to it as well. But I think we said earlier in the campaign there were some games where he was abdicating any responsibility of himself into the situation. It's like you've got to try and, for as bad as the situation might be off the field, you've got to try and get these 11 guys on a side together to try and, if you've got to bang their heads together, to try and form some sort of cohesive unit. And they're just so poor defensively. And they're so poor in attack that I think they're already worse than this Derby team in terms of they've got less points at the same
time. One less point.
And like, great, Chris Wilder comes in. He's probably the cheap option. He's a guy that knows the club, fair enough. He can maybe do something because they're all the same players he had when he fucking left the last time. So it doesn't really matter in that instance. But I do think, it's a hard situation for Heckenbotham to be in. And I think he got fortunate with the promotion last season in terms of sometimes a team just got to hit the form at the right time. And they did. And that's how they got into the... they finished runners up and they went to second place and they ran Burnley kind of close, but there is different aspects to it and they're just not going the right way about things, and it's been kind of shambles off the field for a while, and you do worry for them if they go back down just in terms of the financial mess that's ongoing at the club as well.
Yeah, and I think the whole like throwing players under the bus really, very rarely works, but it works once in a blue moon. But it only actually works if your team have wildly underperformed or done something to genuinely show themselves up. And it is completely and utterly justified. Like, you know, Pochettino threw the Chelsea players under the bus last week after the heavy defeat to Newcastle. But that's a team generally on the up with expensive talent and a manager who's generally quite an arm around the shoulder kind of guy. So, you know what, as a one-off, giving them a public bollocking probably could have a positive effect, and we'll see in due course, but it was a great performance against Brighton at the weekend, which we're not going to cover in detail, so happy to mention there. But, you know, teams at the bottom who are expected to lose more games than win, who are expected to have to fight and graft and, like Alan Shearer says, work harder in all their games to be able to get anything out of them, to start throwing them under the bus from, like, you know, week three against when they got beat 8-0 by Newcastle, week four when they get beat by West Ham, week five when they get beat by Fulham. You know, actually on paper, even a team that survives is likely to get beaten by Newcastle, West Ham, and possibly even Fulham when they're away from home. And it just felt like he was really picking the wrong battles. Whereas conversely, you've got Vincent Kompany in charge of the team with the worst home record in the league, lost their first seven home games. No Premier League team had ever lost eight, and they were going into this one staring down the barrel of that unwanted record. Yet every week he was positive. You know, last week were absolutely excellent. The players were fantastic. They're really buying into what we're trying to do. It will come. We will turn a corner. And they might, you know what, they might not, but at least you can see in these must-win games, the players are willing to run through a brick wall for Kompany and really try and win. Whereas conversely, the Sheffield United boys, yeah, they'll be playing for a degree of personal pride, but that only gets you so far if you know the boy in the dugout's going to be gone in a couple of weeks and you literally couldn't give a fuck what he's got to say. And you know that unless you win, which you're unlikely to do anyway, you're going to get dug out in the press conference afterwards. And I think it was quite telling that the Sheffield United fans stuck around to boo, but didn't really seem to be, and I might just be reading into this because it's sort of, you know, outcome bias, but they didn't seem to be projecting their annoyance specifically at all the players. You know, a lot of it seemed to be aimed at the kind of technical area and possibly the ownership, etc., as well, and Ollie McBurnie for being a fucking idiot. He could have got sent off for the first. It probably isn't a sending off, which is fine. I'm probably content with that. But to be so stupid and do it, what was it, 9 minutes later? And then to have the audacity to look bemused by both, never mind still look bemused by the second one. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Wilder does. He needs to install some positivity in that squad, because they're not going to stay up. So it's almost like he may as well accept his fate now and try and keep the players on board. As for Heckenbottom, I think that'll be his Premier League career over, I would have thought.
I mean, two cracks at it, eh? Because you had the interim basis when they went down.
Down, yeah.
And then managed to come back up with him as well. It's known as sad pick on Heckenbottom as well, but he kind of pulled the same stunt when he was at Hibs. Up here as well, and it's just like, I think he's very much maybe one of the last Mohicans, and it's in the sense that he thinks of the kind of abrasive management style, kind of just be a man, kind of just get on with it kind of attitude that he purveys is it still works, and I don't think it does work at this level. It's all about tacticians now. It's all about people with bright ideas, innovative ideas, and while nothing new in football, it's all recycled. At the end of the day, you are
even just cohesive ideas.
Yeah,
you know, I think we've said before that football players are like the best people in the world at doing what they're told, or sportsmen and sports people in general are often the best people in the world at doing what they're told. Like, you know, that's all they do all day, every day is what they're told. And so, if you tell these 11 Sheffield United players what to do, and what you're telling them to do has some degree of cohesion and common sense and potential for success, then you're standing a good stead. It just seemed to be 11 boys running around in a 4-4-2, not really entirely sure what pieces to put together. It'd be interesting to see if he even gets another championship job. I guess maybe a bottom half team take a punt on him.
Yeah, I think there'll still be championship teams that would kind of suck around a guy who's got Premier League experience. But even then, you're seeing teams like Sheffield Wednesday bringing Danny Rowe, who's not had any kind of prior experience of being a manager, and from kind of Germany, which I know has been a kind of positive kind of pipeline in recent times in terms of championship teams. There's Shun Daya Farka, David Wagner being another one as well. Obviously, Klopp at the top end of really the quality end of that, but I think he...
You've got like middles...
I just meant German club must have been the first one really to open the gateway to German coaching in terms of bringing people's ideas into it to see what they can do. And I think that it's good to have somebody of a different nationality come in before you to say, not necessarily this is what the culture of our country is and what we can bring to it, but it definitely opens doors. And I think that's what you're seeing more like as a fillers than the league, especially the Championship, where there is big money to get into the Premier League, so a lot of teams do throw kind of try to get the most, try to get good coaches in that sense. It's not just necessarily your old hammer throws, as it used to be the case maybe 10, 15 years ago. You'll still get your Warnock getting a job at a firefighter level. But I think you're now seeing the firefighters being at the bottom of the Championship now rather than the Premier
League. Yeah, exactly. And again, the other chain of thought in the Championship as well, Middlesbrough took in Michael Carrick, Ipswich granted League One at the time, but were aiming for the Championship, took in Kieran McKenna. So given these sort of young, interesting coaches a try that have got experience at big clubs. And I think maybe the days of your Paul Heckenbottoms anywhere near the top level are fairly numbered. I genuinely think he'll end up at like Tranmere Rovers and Stevenage, and it'll be one of them. You know, when on Gillette Soccer Saturday, they don't even have a face at the game. It's just the scoreboard and like the boy in the background that like could be fucking anywhere. And he's like, it'll be one of those games in 6 years' time, and it'll be like, oh, and Paul Heckenbottom's Oxford United have conceded for a third time in the first half, going down to Tranmere Rovers, and you're like, oh, fucking hell, Paul Heckenbottom's Oxford United, that's interesting. Like, that's I suspect where his career is going. Because also, like, what I think as well, these guys are so negative and miserable and downbeat in the post-match interviews. Like, that is like your public business development. That is what other clubs see of you. They don't really see you on the training ground, let's be honest, unless you know someone. So what they see is the way that you present yourself on the sidelines, your how your team play, and then how you handle yourself in press conferences. And just, I'd sometimes wonder, like, if you own, you know, let's say Birmingham, you know, they get rid of Rooney because he's had a shocking start, and they're looking for a manager. If you're a Birmingham manager, and you go, oh, this Paul Heckenbottom guy's available, and he's got some Premier League experience, and you think, I bet he's a miserable, sour-faced, moaning bastard every time he's in a press conference. Like, why would we want him anywhere near our club? You know, you want the guys that are positive and happy and conveying a good message about your team, the public face of your squad, after all. It doesn't work like that, because miserable, moaning-faced bastards continue to get a job, but you feel like it does. It must, or it will eventually catch up with some of these guys, particularly if they don't have the kudos to back themselves up. Anything else on Burnley, Sheffield United, Mike?
No. I'm surprised about that much, to be honest.
Guimaraes, Trippier, and Gordon. The only surprise is it's taken until 10 minutes into the second half. Well, this is
Newcastle United 1, Manchester United 0, sees the Magpies leapfrog the Old Trafford side on Saturday evening. Mike, this, we said last week that United were failing the eye test despite being the in-form team. We spoke in depth several times this season at their frailties, but this game, it was like it all came home to roost. It wasn't a thumping in terms of the scoreline, but it was an absolute thumping in terms of the quality that was seen on the pitch.
No, absolutely. Really, when you talk about cohesiveness and got an idea, a plan, like you said about that with Paul Heckenbottom, it's the same with Ten Hag. There doesn't seem to be any kind of thought or reason behind these things. And I know the players are slightly letting themselves down in the way that they carry themselves in the park. But as I said before as well, Ten Hag signed a lot of these boys, a lot of them are injured. But he knows Sofyan Amrabat from his time managing in the Netherlands. He knows Anthony from his time managing Ajax. He knows the likes of Lisandro Martinez and Onana as well. And he knows a lot of these guys that he's brought in. They just don't seem to be cutting it at this level. Harry Maguire's been brought in from the cold, and he's, all right, he's back to his Percy point at best, blaming everybody apart from himself on Saturday evening. But, you know, I mean, Scott McTominay is kind of like one of the better performers, and why we like his what he's done for Scotland and getting all the plaudits for that. He's not kind of that caliber of player that Man United necessarily need to kind of propel them forward and up the leagues. Fernandes, again, moping around the place. You know, it's not really befitting of like a captaincy role, especially at a club where you had like Roy Keane on the sidelines, really charged about setting standards, of course. And Martial is just a busted flush at this point. I don't know if I can name any more players that are massively disappointing Man United at this moment in time, but. As much as Ten Hag's got, he's got his detractors, and he's not got a lot going for him. And he's another one of these torn faced bastards as well. It's like all the players have got to point, look themselves in the mirror and start pointing fingers at maybe that they've got a kind of just got to put some application on it. And it sounds simple, and it's not kind of like any tactical foresight, but just run a bit more. You know what I mean? And it's just as plain as simple as that. It's like Rashford just kind of throwing his hands up when he gets beat on the sidelines for a ball as well. Like
defensively, that clip they had of Rashford, it's one of them where he's so poor in the game. He's throwing his hands up so often and he's so disinterested that you find it sometimes difficult to pull out those specific individual moments. And then when they highlighted it on Match of the Day, where the guy literally just... it was at Livramento, just skips past him like he's not even there. And you think, fucking hell, this is Marcus Rashford, experienced Premier League player, experienced England international. And there's a young whippersnapper literally just gliding past him like he's not even there. And he just turns around and looks at him. You know, Roy Keane said in the Sky Sports studio, you know, he's 26 now, he's not a kid. You know, he needs to be the one putting in the big performances every week. And I was going to ask you about three players. Mike, Marcus Rashford was the first one. And you, Sheila, and I gave Saka a pep talk. We gave him a boost because he clearly listens to the show and took it on board and says that at that time he was maybe 19, 20, and it really didn't look like he was going to kick on. You know, we're talking probably 24 months ago now, and that he needed to have a sort of big second half of the season and, you know, start putting some chances away, start showing some gusto and some power in his performances, or you know, he's staring down the barrel of a sort of Theo Walcott-esque career, which in hindsight for a 19-year-old was a bit harsh. And at the time, you know, was Mikel Arteta's team that was finishing sort of eighth in the Premier League. But I think a lot of those comments that we said at that time about Saka categorically apply, and with probably more fairness, to Rashford right now, a guy who is 26, who hasn't won a major trophy. What has he got? A League Cup and a Europa League to his name?
Europa League,
you know,
Van Gaal or Mourinho, one of the two.
But yeah, whichever one it was. You know, obviously no Premier Leagues, no FA Cups, I don't think, and he maybe has one from 7 years ago that I'm forgetting about or something, but not... You know, he's not got a bursting trophy cabinet, despite being a Man United starlet. He hasn't done anything for England. And after the World Cup last year, he really seemed to kick on. He seemed to be a new type of player. And we thought we were seeing a new side to Rashford. And he's regressed enormously this year. I said I was going to ask you about him. I'm kind of in the process of telling you about, but I wonder if you have any additional comments. And does he need to, without it getting too dramatic, does he need to leave United? Does he just need to get out of that entire setup, his entire where he's been as a child, and just give himself a new challenge, whether that's, you know, probably abroad most realistically?
I mean, quite possibly. While you've been talking, I've been looking up just some of the numbers. So his best goal scoring seasons for United in the league have been 17 goals. I guess 17 goals in 31 games just before the last, was it, bridging the kind of COVID season. So there is that. And then last season, he got 17 and 35. So those are his best two attempts. Other than that, it's been 5-5, 7-10, 17, 11, 4, 17, and now he's got two. And he's just not getting himself into these kind of instances where you feel like he's going to score. When he does get a chance, he's taken just too many touches. And Theo Walcott's probably the best kind of comparison to it. Is like Rashford isn't quite a number nine. He's more of a kind of winger guy. And it was the same with Theo Walcott as well. And you always thought Theo Walcott was going to burst through. When he did get the kind of goal scoring, that you thought, right, this is the season he's going to kick on. And in his case, it'd be a lot of injuries that would set him back. But as Rashford, just seems like he's just a very streaky player. He just really seems to run very hot and cold. I don't know if it's like not necessarily a temperament in the way that he carries himself in training, etc. But I think it's just more the mentality that whether he's got a confidence about him. And I think that he needs maybe the arm around him more so often than not. And while Roy Keane does point out he's kind of an older kind of head in the dressing room as well, age doesn't necessarily bring that into a player. You could still need that kind of boost in morale, where maybe Roy Keane can kind of go about his business where he never needed to tell he's done a good job. Maybe Rashford is a guy that needs to be told he's doing a good job or he's doing the right things. And I don't think you're going to get that off Ten Hag. And I don't think you're going to get that off Steve McLaren as well, whose head's in the clouds, going by some of his past judgments in terms of the way he's managed players in the past as well. So I do think there's maybe that not that support base, and maybe a change of scenery would do him the world of good. It is a shame because obviously he's Manchester. He's one of these guys that come through the academy, and he's got over 300 appearances for the club. He's done exceptionally well for England, I suppose, in a lot of times. But again, his England goal scoring record is not fantastic either. So
I wouldn't say he has done exceptionally well for England. I would say he was okay in Euro 2016. I'm fairly sure he started up front with Vardy in that tournament. And that was the last one under Roy, and it was fine. And then he did well in that previous World Cup, but then England, you know, fell short at quarterfinal stage, wasn't anywhere near where they wanted to get to. you know, he's never been a Rooney figure. He's never been a talisman. He's never been Kane or Shearer or Lineker or anything even remotely like that for England. And I just, yeah, I think that he just, that the whole sort of setup around United just seems to be weighing him down. And he's a guy that doesn't seem to naturally want to try hard, which isn't specifically a criticism. You know, some people do need that encouragement all the time to want to try hard. He just doesn't seem like a guy that naturally, he's not James Milner that'll just chuck in 13 kilometers a game for the sake of chucking in 13 kilometers a game. He needs the encouragement, I think, and suspect he would probably do quite well out of the sort of UK press limelight. I'm not suggesting he has to go to a poor club. You know, I'm not saying like, oh, he'd do a job for Everton or Palace, or he should go to Torino and Serie A. I genuinely think he would do well at a big club. I think, you know,
Dortmund would be
Dortmund's the obvious one, but even Bayern Munich and hook up with Kane and play on their wing. Even Inter Milan, who are going great guns again. AC Milan has proven to be a really good spot for a couple of English players that needed a change of scenery. He's probably unlikely to go to sort of Barcelona, Real Madrid, just the nature of those teams. And PSG is definitely not going to be the right, that kind of like toxicity and playing under Mbappe at all times is probably the absolute worst place he could go. But I would have thought Germany or Italy could do wonders for him and maybe take him out of that kind of being top of the bill on Talk Sport, you know, every single week, whether he's done well or poorly. Two more players I wanted to ask you about, Mike, as our sort of way of going through this game. Next one was Harry Maguire, someone that we've given a fair amount of stick to, and he did have his classic Harry Maguire moment by the ball coming off him and going into the net while he was offside at the end to potentially deny his own team an equaliser, having been lumped up front by Ten Hag. But I wanted to maybe look at it in a more nuanced way than perhaps we've done so before, in saying that he is clearly in good form at the moment, and he is getting plaudits from you know, lots of writers and ex-players in the media. But is it almost an indication or a symptom, if that's the right word, or evidence rather, of how poor Man United are, in that we now see a genuinely informed Harry Maguire, and they're almost like a seesaw, because Harry Maguire is clearly at his best in a team that is regularly under the cosh, that needs back to walls defending, that needs to win headers, win tackles, get the ball lumped up the field. And that is not where Man United should be. And actually, when he was poor and we thought he was past it and his career at United was over, was during their sort of periods of better form last year, when they were playing slightly better football. They were trying to play out from the back. They were trying to build through the phases. And they generally did well sort of domestically and in Europe. So, you know, is it evidence of how poor United are, in that their current style and need of play makes Harry Maguire look good?
Well, they've still been conceding goals up until recently when he came in. And I suppose, like you said, they didn't pass the eye test in the spate of four wins in a row that they did have leading into this game. It's just a case that they're trying to hang their hat on something. It's Euro season as well. We all know he's one of Southgate's favourites, so maybe he garners a favourable press in that sense, that if he's in the squad and playing, then it looks favourable for the England side in the summer as well. He's not a bad player by any means, and he probably gets a bit more stick than he deserves because of some of these mannerisms on the park as well. But I do think there's a case that he's not quite what you need him to be, and it's not quite what you want him to be in a team that's going forward. It's not John Stones. He's not Kyle Walker. He's not one of these great stalwart of English defenders that they've got moving forward. And you kind of think, like, Pep wanted him a Man City. And you think, all right, that's interesting. What would Pep necessarily have done with him now to improve them massively? And I just think it would have been a misstep for Pep to sign him. I don't think he would have brought him on leaps and bounds. I just think he is just kind of a guy that's, because he played a very stereotypical English kind of centre-back performance when it was kind of fading out and John Tenney had long retired, that he came to the fore, and it gave people that kind of same kind of belief about a guy who's still had like the tough tackling in him, still wanted to get involved in the rough and tumble. And I don't think that's defenders these days, especially with the games going. It's more about interceptions, it's more about being in the right place at the right time. And I just think he's kind of a guy who'd, you know, if Harry Maguire were to go down the leagues and play in League Two when he was 40, he'd love it and he'd thrive. But that kind of rough and tumble with the big burly bastard centre forward that he'd come up against. And I just don't think that's where defending's going. So he's kind of like one of the last, really. He's like one of the last of a dying art in terms of a centre back who really wants to get involved in the physical battle. And he can play football. It's not that he can't play football, but he just can't do it to a standard like a Van Dijk can or a John Stones. And I know that's setting the bar really high, but he just doesn't have that mentality. And that's where Man United have gone wrong. They've just been kind of 2 years too late in picking the wrong players. And that's where they've kind of caught a cropper in the transfer market, whereas a lot of people are doing smart business these days in Man United, one of the teams that are not. And Harry Maguire at 70 million was emblematic of that.
And the last player I wanted to ask you about was Anthony Gordon for Newcastle. We weren't shy for maybe taking the piss a bit when he went last January. We were vindicated because he was pish. But a little bit more time under Eddie Howe's tutelage seems to be working wonders for him, and perhaps benefited as well from some of the injury problems at Newcastle, and that he's had to be a bit more of a talisman. He's filled in as a centre forward when Isak and Wilson were injured. He was back to his more familiar left wing role in this game. But a guy that's always in and around the goals and in and around the box. You know, he's got 6 goals this season, 3 assists. You maybe, other than Kieran Trippier, could argue he's been a Newcastle standout player so far this season, and is surely chapping on the England door as well.
Well, that's just what I say. When he was pishing with Steve Clark, gave him a call up a year ago to get him into the Scotland side, because you'd love him now. And I think, not Clark, sorry, Southgate's not managed to fill in the stone-shaped hole that's been missing since he's been left in the sidelines for whatever reason. And I think, well, Foden's been there and it's kind of his position. He's not kind of nailed it down on an England platform, whereas I think Gordon's maybe more suited in terms of the hard working and the endeavour side of it as well. That suits Southgate's side and could probably work well and kind of mesh with Harry Kane as well. And I think him on one side, Saka on the other side, I think you've got a good blend of kind of the hard working and the endeavour side, and you've also got the talent and the guy that can chip in goals. And I think that front three, and I'm not saying Gordon would start every game at the Euros or that, but as an option, I think that'd give them a bit more impetus in attack. And I think, I think the Scotland ship sadly sailed by with Anthony Gordon.
Yeah, no, he's not the only one in that team as well that could play for Scotland, with Tino Livramento as well. And I think that ship might be setting sail as we speak, which is obviously a shame for Scotland fans. But no, it is great to see a player like Gordon. He maybe didn't go about his move in the right way, and maybe didn't work out for him initially, but to sort of start to take his opportunity and really kick on. And 9 goal involvements is the most in the team. You know, Wilson and Isak have 7 goals each. Kieran Trippier has 7 assists. So Gordon's standing out in that regard, and they're not too far removed from his expected figures either, which is usually a sign that that's the kind of stuff he's going to be able to maintain. And that'll be vital for Newcastle, who have had a reasonable start to the season, Mike, but perhaps don't find themselves where they want to be, possibly going out of the Champions League as well. So looking at sort of Sunday, Thursday football in the new year. But from their perspective, a thoroughly deserved and effective win against United.
No, absolutely, especially St. James's Park. I mean, it's difficult for teams to go up there now. And you can see it being a real cauldron for the home fans, and they've got really belief behind their side now that Ashley is gone. They've got kind of a cohesive kind of unit all around the club, and I know it's tainted in Saudi money, but in a sense, to a normal, everyday going fan who just wants to spend his Saturday away from like the toils of everyday life, for him to go or her to go enjoy the football, I think it's a special place to be at St James's Park at the moment. And listen, you've got to give your flowers to Teddy Howe in that regard as well. He's turned them into a team that was battling relegation and into the Champions League in a very short space of time. And I know it's a lot of money involved in that, but still, a lot of clubs that have spent a lot of money haven't achieved what they've done in such a short period of time either.
Yeah, absolutely. That'll do for the Premier League this week, heading into the midweeks tomorrow, in fact, or probably today or even yesterday by the time you're listening to this. But we'll touch on HJK 2, Aberdeen 2.
With Duke. And again, shooting opportunity. What a strike that is! That is an absolute cracker from Angus McDonald. Not a prolific goal scorer, the central defender. But that is one for the showreel.
Absolute screamer by Angus McDonald to get us back on our way.
Thursday. You can tell by Ron McLean's commentary. Like, he didn't,
I know.
Considering he's kind of a Northern Scottish kind of representative, I thought he'd be getting a wee bit more than that.
He does the club TV as well. You know, he does Red TV commentary. I looked him up, the TNT commentary up, because I thought he'd be buzzing, and then he wasn't. So fuck's sake. He's not buzzing for the Duke equaliser either, which is why I just stuck with that one. Freezing. It's funny watching the highlights of this, because it looks like when we used to play the Friday Night League back in the mid-2000s, where the AstroTurf was frozen and you're playing with a plastic ball and it's like skidding about. It looked pretty ridiculous, actually, seeing the highlights back. Fucking freezing, you know, minus 20 for the game, snow coming down. We got into the stadium about 15 minutes before kickoff, and you get to the pie stand, they say, oh, sorry, we've not got any hot food left. And you're like, how can you not have any hot food left? It's minus 20 degrees, not got like soup or anything. And they're like, oh no, there's obviously a lot of fans here. I was like, we all bought the tickets about a month ago. Like, surely you knew how many folk were going to be here. And it's Finland in fucking December, so get in some hot scran. I was really hoping that they had some kind of reindeer pie or burger or something, and whatever the Finnish equivalent of a Bovril was, to try and get some heat in my bones. Instead, I bought a pint. And as you're standing there watching the game, no word of a lie, the pint starts to crystallise in your hand. So you take a sip and you're getting all these like wee ice cubes bobbing about in the pint, which was not great. The team put out by Aberdeen was a disgrace as well. Maybe one or two shandies in when I tweeted Alan Burrows telling him that it was a disgrace. But I stand by the fact that it was a shambles. And it would have only been vindicated with victory against Hibs on Sunday. So inevitably, we lost 2-0 in that game, despite, as Robson will tell you, having 22 shots on goal and a lot of good chances. But 1,500 travelling fans, most of them will have spent about £1,000 on that trip between tickets, flights, hotels, and then being there for a couple of days as well. And then to put out, you know, it's not rotation. I got a bit of kickback from some Aberdeen fans saying, oh, he's criticised for no rotating, he's criticised for rotating, what's he meant today? And you're like, oh, don't play Jack Milne and his club debut at right back for a start. He's not a right back, and it's his debut. And in a game that, if we win, we get 500 grand for, and it helps the coefficient, and it helps some confidence, and there's 1,500 travelling away fans that have come to see it in minus 20. Angus McDonald getting his first start of the season. He started Johnny Hayes and Ryan Duncan together, which meant Ryan Duncan was playing centre mid. You know, he started Pappas Gay up front for his debut. I did enjoy the Aberdeen fans singing the We Buy Any Car chant, singing Came All This Way to See Papa Gay, which is one of the small shining lights in the game. The game itself, we were absolutely atrocious until that Angus McDonald shot went in, which kind of dug us out of a hole. And then in the second half, looked the better team. We made some changes. You've seen the stark difference in quality with people like Bojan coming on late on as well, the difference he would have made to that team. Duke's troubles continued, and we just don't look like a cohesive football team, despite having several genuinely fantastic football players in the team. You know, Gartman's one of the best centre backs I've seen in Yonks. Jensen's tremendous. Bojan is tremendous. Baron is tremendous. And you think, why is this team so fucking bad? Rubisic would be fine in any kind of otherwise reasonably performing team. Yeah, he's a bit of a liability, but sort of sandwiching between two competent centre backs, and he can do a decent job. But yeah, really disappointing performance. And then to back it up with a 2-0 defeat against Hibs and what was largely a must win, we now come into this week with two games that, again, we must win, including Hearts at the weekend before going into the cup final. And, you know, Aberdeen are now 10 points behind Hearts with a game in hand, even further behind St Mirren. European football next year is looking off the table. We've scored less points than we did last year, and we thought we were shite this time last year. And you've really got to question how long this Robson debacle continues. I hate asking for new managers. And, you know, we had Calderwood for so long and then McInnes for so long. And, you know, this would be, what, four permanent managers in as many years or something like that, roughly. You know,
McInnes, Glass,
Goodwin, Robson. So it'd be the fifth. It'd be the fifth in as many years, which is not what you want at all. But you just don't know. You just can't see how this can continue. We've spent a lot of money in the summer. He's been backed. A lot of the guys that have come in aren't working out. It looks like Rhys William and Uadadi are both going to have their loans terminated in January. Pappas Gay was 500 grand. It looks like that's going down the drain. And I know Robson's not responsible for all of that. And perhaps in terms of signings, he's not responsible for any of it. But he does have the tools at his disposal to be getting a much better tune out of the players he's got. And it looks like we've blown the chance of getting any money for Duke with him not going in the summer. And we might get good money.
He looks poor as well. He looks really poor.
He's a guy that I think fitness doesn't come naturally to. I don't think he's a guy that's like...
Like me.
like us both, Mike. he's not a guy that just naturally goes out and, you know, runs around and doesn't have to think about it. He clearly has to work very hard at keeping himself in shape, but he's so much better off the left. I think every Aberdeen fan would agree that, and he's been asked to play through the middle too often. He doesn't know where to be. He doesn't know how to make runs. He doesn't know how to press. He's better off the left in a front three with Bojan in the middle and another winger. Shaden Morris getting injured early in the season kind of didn't particularly help that way forward. We're very wedded to a back five when regularly we need to break teams down. And I know why he brought a back five in last year, because we were shipping loads of goals and we needed to change something up, and it worked. But last year, teams continued to come and have a go at us because we'd been shite. That's not the case this year. Teams are sticking in and inviting us onto them. We don't know what to do about it. You know, Hibs were just playing a long ball against us with Martin Boyle running in behind. And so you don't need a back five for that. You need more players in the forward positions to try and break the opposition down. So another depressing season for the Dons. The crazy thing was that most of last year was depressing too. We were just fortunate in how it ended, and it's given us this European run, which we haven't really had anything to shout about in either, because we haven't won any games, which has been mightily disappointing. And it very much looks like there's only going to be one season of guaranteed group stage football left for the Scottish sides, which means you need to finish third. And we're in the process of throwing that away as well. And it's almost like when Mourinho got sacked by Spurs before the cup final. And the reason being that they didn't want him to win the cup final and then feel like they had to stick by him. And how hard it is to sack a cup winning manager. And I want that for Robson. I want them to get rid of Robson now before the cup final, because if he beats Rangers on the 17th, we're stuck with him for at least a month, if not longer. Because how do you get rid of the guy that's won your first trophy in 9 years? How do you get rid of the guy that's beat Rangers in a cup final at Hampden? But if we're still sitting 3 points above the relegation zone, you know, that's not sustainable. It doesn't suit the business model either for supposedly bringing in young foreign talent and churning it out. So something's got to give, Mike. And hopefully it'll be Robson.
Who would you turn to, or who would you like if Robson were to go?
I've got no idea.
Kind of had a taste of everything. You had Glass, who came across from America.
Yeah.
And it was forward thinking manager potentially. You had, and you'd invited to Goodwin,
who was doing well domestically.
Yeah, trying and trusted at this level. Then Robson, who was like the guy who's from the inner sanctum, kind of worked his way up. So it was like you kind of had a flavour of all kind of, you're really going down to the foreign market now and getting your Daniel Stendel. That's kind of what Aberdeen have got to go for.
And the worry was that we clearly tried to do that when Robson got the job, and it must have been that no standout candidate really came forward. And that's why Robson stayed for so long and then ended up getting the job permanently. So there is a worry there. And this board haven't appointed a manager yet. You know, like you say, that's Glass, Goodwin, and Robson even kind of gave himself the job as much as anything. And so they've got them all wrong so far. So I would be worried and I would be nervous. But I do also sort of buy into the idea that it's not really a fan's job to know, you know, who's doing well in Hungary or Turkey or Georgia, who has good enough English that could come in and do well. I don't buy into the idea that it has to be a domestic coach to succeed. We've seen Hibs now try the Australian market. So, you know, there's no reason something like that wouldn't be an option. We just need to do something. I don't think there's anyone, or I know for a fact, there's no one domestically that I'd be excited about us appointing. Certainly don't want Martindale, as much as Grant keeps trying to tell me he would be a good appointment. Don't want Martindale. And what's his face at St Mirren?
Stephen Robinson. Your fingers have already been bumped with that.
Just be a good one.
The Irishman from St Mirren.
It would just go in another good one. So, I also wouldn't want a jobber from down south. You know, I wouldn't want a League One numpty. If it's somebody, I have the same ethos with players and managers. I want somebody doing well. I don't care at what level to start with. Just somebody doing well. I'd rather sign, to be fair, a manager from the Conference or League Two in England who's winning week in, week out with a style of football and sees Aberdeen as a step up, than get a guy from the Championship or Premiership who's just been relegated, who's getting beat all the time. I agree that with a player as well. I'd rather get a striker two or three levels below who can't stop scoring than a guy from your level who's getting 4 and 15 and that you're hoping will play differently in your squad. Get guys that are doing well, that are looking to move up. And that Ange is the perfect example of that, isn't he? You know, he's a guy that he has done extremely well at every stage of his career and has just had to slowly take those steps up. And I'm more than happy for Aberdeen these days to be a stepping stone to an extent for a manager moving on to potentially bigger and better things, because it means we get them for 2 or 3 years. And that can hopefully bring with it success. And then we do it again with the next guy and the next guy. And, you know, who knows, one of them might stay a bit longer. I've got every reason to think that's why McInnes came to Aberdeen in the first place, was because he's seen it as a way of getting his career back on track and as a stepping stone, and stayed for 8 seasons. I tell you what, I honestly wouldn't even put it past, Cormac to bring McInnes back. I don't think he's going to get a Rangers or anybody bigger. I would be surprised if he was holding out per se for the Hearts.
I think McInnes' next job would be Scotland.
I was going to say, is he waiting for Steve Clarke? But do you see Steve Clarke going anywhere? He's not an old man.
5 years, not in the next 5 years. But in 5 years' time, say he were to get the Scotland job, he'd be older than Steve Clarke was when he took the Scotland job.
Mm.
Which I suppose is a fascinating fact of time. But I can see you trying to pinch McInnes, but I don't know, maybe fingers burnt. Is Stuart Milne still in the
Stuart Milne still there or thereabouts? And I think, I don't know, McInnes always just speaks about Aberdeen with a degree of positivity that you wouldn't necessarily expect from a manager that was treated the way he was on TV, that makes me just sometimes wonder if there's just a wee something in the back of his head thinking Dave might pick up that phone again and be like, oh, I'm really sorry, Derek, I've made a really big mistake. I thought I knew better.
Or Dick Campbell, he's just left Arbroath.
There's
a vacant area. Aberdeen. It'd be a good laugh. I mean, if Craig Levein could get a job in the top flight, surely the fuck Dick Campbell could get a job in the top flight. Come on.
Yeah, there is that. Dick Campbell and Christ, who was going to say Yogi Hughes can come in as well? I'm sure he's looking for a job. Ralph Raniak is only in, not Ralph Raniak, Ralph Hasenhüttl is apparently still dicking about in Northampton somewhere waiting for a job, so we can get him up. Right. Tartan tie, free tartan ties.
Well, I suppose, I know we're kind of wrapping up here, but I suppose, like, they'll talk about, like, Cooper leaving Nottingham Forest and Lopetegui going in there.
Yeah.
So I think we are getting to the kind of hiring and firing season. And listen, like you said, if things don't go well for Aberdeen in the next month or two, you're right, I think they could start being a few vacancies up here as well.
Yeah, exactly. And we're a progressive team trying to do the right thing. So, yeah, look, would we get Steve Cooper? Absolutely not. But, you know, if a guy from the right end of an English league or the right end of a European league came available, maybe we could. And interestingly, the boy, is it Knutsen, Bodø/Glimt, has never actually really ended up getting that big move that everyone seemed to think he might have been holding out for. He was obviously touted with Aberdeen, Celtic, Rangers, and there was kind of a degree of thinking that none of those teams could get anywhere near him, but doesn't seem to have gone anywhere else. So,
they're playing in Europe, weren't they?
They still are
doing all right. I mean, that's Cifuentes went to QPR and he's done a bit of wonders with them as well. So, like the coaches are out there. I'd hope after Cafro, which kind of sets Scotland back slightly, but well, he's available too. You can get him. him and Nuno got sacked after Saudi Arabia, but I just hope they'd be a bit more forthcoming to like a progressive outside kind of manager, because as we've seen the domestic scene just now, isn't all that. And Bodø/Glimt to go out European Europa Conference group as well. So I mean, there's still hope and potential, I suppose, for him to kick on and maybe get something down the line. But yeah, it'd be interesting where Aberdeen do go. And I think it would be listen, I've been an admirer of Byron Robson in the main, and it's because you bypass the best part of your team as a cohesive unit, and that's in midfield. It's back to front too often, and like when you've got a boy like Gnofsky up top, I can understand the need to try and feed him as often as possible. But I think the main strength is the midfield, and just to bypass it. When you've got players like Clarkson, Graham Shinney, Conor Barron, as you said, coming through, I think that's negligence in the extreme.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm now thoroughly depressed on a Monday before heading into the midweeks. It's been a pleasure, Mike. Great to catch up with you so early in the week. Again, some cracking fixtures coming up Tuesday to Thursday and then the weekends. We'll be back next week to look back over all of that. Let's be honest, we'll probably forget what happened in most of the midweeks. But if there's a big talking point that makes it through, and who knows, to be honest, by next midweek when we record again, I wouldn't be hugely surprised to see Steve Cooper and Erik ten Hag joining Paul Heckenbottom in the job centre. We'll wait and see. But usually when one domino falls, it kind of kickstarts the other teams, because I think you find that the teams that are touch and go don't want to risk losing out on the guy that they were going to bring in. And, Nottingham Forest might worry that they might lose out to Lopetegui if a lot of other teams start sacking boys. So we'll see what happens. But thank you very much for your time, Mike. Really appreciate it as always. And I'll speak to you next week. Cheerio.